Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU.
This week, is TikTok causing digital burnout in artists? Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to take a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when we announced details about the next editions of Artist Entrepreneur Day.
Actually, I think we might have done that the week before last, but now you've given me an opportunity to do some plugging.
It's all right. It's fine. We don't have to talk about it.
Let's do some plugging. Ah, no. You've opened the plugging door, and we all know once the plugging door is open, it cannot be closed. That's the rules. They're not my rules. Those are just the rules. So, yes, the Artist Entrepreneur Day is the artist-led education program from the Featured Artist Coalition and us here at CMU. And we're doing two in-person editions for obvious reasons. We've done a lot of online editions of this event over the last couple of years, although we did do an in-person one in Manchester last year. And we've got two more in-person editions coming up thanks to Arts Council England support. So we are going, I say we, Andy's not going to be there. If the only reason you're coming to this is to meet Andy Mole, he's not there. Maybe I'll get you on Zoom to answer everybody's questions.
Maybe. I should come to some events sometime, shouldn't I?
Maybe. Well, you came to The Great Escape.
Well, I quite liked that. So, I started thinking maybe I should actually leave my house sometime.
No, I think they've been to The Great Escape. That's it for 4 years. But,
based on past form, yes.
So our first Ask the Entrepreneur Day is happening on Saturday, the 25th of June. It's happening in Hull at the venue Social. And basically, with our Ask the Entrepreneur Days, we have free FAC Ask the Entrepreneurs who unlock and open up their artist businesses. So I explain how music rights work and how streaming works and how the live side of the business works. And then they give you practical case studies from their businesses. Plus, we're joined by a bunch of industry experts to answer lots of questions. So in Hull, El Shant, Stuart Baxter and Katie Spencer are our artist entrepreneurs who will be joining myself. And then the following week, we're going to Southampton. So we'll be in Southampton on the 2nd of July. These are both Saturdays where we will be joined by Ren and Russell Marsden from Band of Skulls and Benny Busy, who will, again, be opening up their artist businesses. So two events coming up. You can either come in person or you can tune in online. So we will put links. This is where
I could go in via Zoom.
You could actually. You could watch by Zoom. We, and on this occasion, we means Andy rather than me, we will put links in the podcast notes to all the information about both of those events and where you can book free tickets. It doesn't cost you a penny to come to the Ask the Entrepreneur Day in Hull later this month or in Southampton on the 2nd of July. I've got my plugging out of the way. I should stress, particularly if this is the first time you've tuned into Setlist, this is not just 40 minutes of me plugging CMU events. We're not actually here to talk about the Artist Entrepreneur Day at all this week.
No, because later on, we're going to be discussing criticism of the UK Collecting Society PRS's decision to reduce the funding it provides to the PRS Foundation. But first, the UK's Music Managers Forum has published a new report based on two roundtable discussions with its members on the topic of digital burnout, making a number of proposals for how the music industry can better help artists meet the demands of being an always-on creator in the social media age. Now this, as you might be thinking now, proved quite timely, it being published shortly after a big debate blew up online about the pressures being placed by the music industry on artists, particularly female artists, to be heavily active on TikTok. That online debate brought much wider attention to an ongoing conversation within the music community regarding just how much time artists and their teams now have to spend creating content for and engaging with social media.
Yes, and the MMF actually staged these roundtables in response to a number of articles and conference panels on that very topic in recent months and the last year or so. We all know, obviously, that music marketing today is centred on digital marketing, which often involves pushing out content via different social media channels to keep existing fans engaged, and of course the hope being that through spending some money on digital advertising and pursuing influencer partnerships and by encouraging the existing fans to share content that is being posted, that all of that activity will help grow the fan base as well, driving more streams, selling more tickets, etc. But Of course, creating that constant stream of content is often unrealistic for artists who have many other demands on their time and who don't necessarily find creating such content all that easy or all that enjoyable. And if too much time is spent making all of this marketing content and interacting with social media, well, first of all, that risks reducing the amount of time available to any one artist to actually make music, which is, at the end of the day, what they are meant to be focused on primarily. Plus, all of those demands can have negative impacts on an artist's mental health. Then there's also the frustration that some record labels and digital platforms sometimes try to force what is basically a one-size-fits-all approach on all artists when we know, really, don't we, that what kind of content is going to work on what platforms and what constitutes success in terms of the data that comes back from these platforms is going to depend very much on each artist and their fan base. But what managers and artists are saying is sometimes within the industry, the flexibility that is required to properly excel in this space isn't always available.
Now, as I said, that particular frustration has popped up lately in the context of TikTok, with some artists complaining that their labels are demanding they engage with TikTok in some way as part of their release campaigns. Of course, we all know that TikTok is now a key music marketing tool, but I guess the point is that that doesn't mean it's appropriate for every artist to just open up the TikTok app and start posting something, anything, to just tick the TikTok tick box.
Yeah, I like ticking the TikTok tick box. That's a good expression.
Yes, bit of a tongue twister. It was Halsey who first brought this particular artist gripe to wider attention. And interestingly, she did that via TikTok itself. In a post on the platform, she said, "Basically, I have a song that I love that I want to release ASAP, but my record label, which is Universal's Capital, won't let me. My record company is saying that I can't release it unless they can make a fake viral moment on TikTok. Everything is marketing, and they're doing this to basically every artist these days. I just want to release music, man, and I deserve better, to be honest. I'm tired." Somewhat ironically, that statement then went viral on TikTok and subsequently on other social platforms too, and indeed, I mean, much more widely, and so much so that some people have gone on to suggest that Halsey complaining about the music industry's obsession with contrived TikTok marketing stunts was a contrived TikTok marketing stunt in itself, especially after, you know, later Capital then announced that it will release the track in question, which is called So Good, on the 9th of June. So that further fueled that conspiracy theory, which I'm going to avoid any doubt, I think, is a stupid conspiracy theory anyway. But whatever your take on that, we shouldn't ignore that Halsey's concerns about the need to be always on in the social media age are shared by many other artists.
Yeah, shortly before Halsey's post, FK Twigs posted a TikTok with the caption, "All record labels ask for are TikToks, and I got told off today for not making enough effort." Meanwhile, artists like Florence Welch and Charlie XCX have also made similar posts too, relatively recently. Meanwhile, Ollie Sykes of Bring Me the Horizon recently told Kerrang, "I feel sorry for this generation of artists. Most labels want you to do skits for TikTok or be thinking about your social media preference, and that alone is a full-time gig. I can't imagine what it would be like to be a new artist and have that responsibility. It's not just making music, you've also got to be an actor almost." He then noted how his wife, who is alt-pop artist Lissick, is experiencing that at the moment, and he said it's just mad that this has become the way the music industry works. Meanwhile, in an opinion piece for The Guardian, Rebecca Taylor, aka Self Esteem, said, "I think it's no coincidence that the recent examples of artists who say their labels have forced them to get on TikTok are all women. My pub psychologist's theory is that the music industry thinks of social media as an inherently female thing. It's just another patriarchal idea that women and gay men are interested in the minutiae of other women, while men are just too busy and important to be interested in that stuff. Much like male artists are just too important and busy to create it. I'm generalising, Ed Sheeran has also expressed his ambivalence about TikTok, but there is something darker and more invasive in the way that women are encouraged to use it. It only furthers the nagging feeling that as a female artist, your music and art aren't taken as seriously."
Now, in her article, Taylor does say that she's always used social media as an extra arm to her art, which I guess is an important thing to note. For some artists, creating content for social media and interacting with their fans on there is another aspect of their creativity and something they enjoy. At The Great Escape last month, we had Rachel Chinnariri on stage as part of the CMU TGE conference, and she spoke about how she engages with her audience on TikTok and the fact that she enjoys doing it. yes, on one level, she is using TikTok and her label urge her to use TikTok because it's a great marketing tool, but it's also part of being a creator. That said, even where an artist enjoys creating social media content and interacting with fans on those platforms, it's still a big time and resource drain, and I guess that's where working with a TikTok-savvy label really helps. Rachel is signed to Parlophone and talked about how they support her social media activity day to day. For independent artists, it can be very hard to find the time and resource to do this stuff, even when you find it creatively fulfilling. And then there are those artists who are making brilliant music, but who don't enjoy being on TikTok, or where interacting with fans on social media isn't really appropriate for their creative persona. Which brings us back to one of the themes of the MMF Digital Burnout Report, that labels need to realise there is no one-size-fits-all approach here, and they need to find alternative ways to keep social media refreshed where it's not practical or appropriate to have the artist constantly recording bits to camera.
Yeah, so this MMF report begins by stating, managers on the roundtables brought up the huge pressure being applied by labels for artists to generate a continuous stream of content, as well as the tendency of labels to judge an artist's value based on the social media numbers rather than the integrity of their music. It then also said that on these roundtables, various comments have been made about how some labels overlook the fact that every artist is different and therefore may not be suited for every social media and digital platform, while others prefer not to engage on social media full stop and would rather responsibility be devolved, and the managers would like labels to recognise that fact. Of course, what that basically means, and I think we all know this, is that ultimately every artist needs a bespoke digital marketing plan. But of course, adopting a more bespoke approach to each artist's digital marketing requires more resource at the labels. And many of the managers, according to the MMF report, reckon that in many cases, the music industry's digital marketing teams are often under-resourced, overworked, and in some cases, pretty junior in experience. The report went on, many managers felt that as digital content is a creative expression for the artists, as well as a promotional marketing tool, relationships with digital teams should be considered as thoughtfully as with the A&R team or when you're matching an artist with a producer. Label digital teams need to become more tailored to ensure they are suited to the artist that they're working with.
That said, while labels could potentially find better ways to work with artists on their digital content and marketing strategies, as we noted, things are even more challenging for independent artists not actively working with a label. Because, label or not, in most cases, artists do need to be active on the social platforms to grow and engage a fan base. And as a result, self-releasing artists are even more likely to experience digital burnout. The report says, with less of a support network behind them, these entrepreneurial artists can experience an overwhelming amount of work with digital choices and obligations leading to burnout. Adding to this workload, managers and artists are now expected to become social media experts to generate content. Managers and artists now need to master Photoshop, video editing, knowledge of algorithm behaviours and other digital skill sets. Managers working with self-releasing artists also noted the lack of industry-led digital education and resources for artists, a lack of finance to create impactful digital marketing campaigns, and limited staff support, and said that self-releasing artists also have the issue that brands who used to partner with them now want to see even bigger digital stats for consideration of financial support.
The managers who took part in these roundtables also talked about some of the frustrations with digital services, by which they really mean the streaming services. And they said that some streaming platforms put too much emphasis on social media stats when deciding what artists and tracks to champion and playlist. Plus, building strong relationships with streaming services often adds to the social media workload. Why? Well, says the report, managers are also exhausted from constant demands to publicly thank streaming services whenever a new streaming landmark is reached. Also discussed was authenticity, questions as to whether these service shoutouts were necessary and if the services even acknowledged them and acted upon them by providing more support to the artist down the line.
The report makes a number of recommendations for how labels, digital services, managers and the wider industry can help with the issues around digital burnout. That includes more resources for digital marketing teams, a more bespoke approach to each artist's digital marketing plan, storing of content to allow artists to take breaks from social media, more access to insights on what works on social media, and more training and mental health support for artists and managers. The report also adds that there was also a suggestion to set up an independent body to instigate discussions between all stakeholders, which includes artists, managers, labels, social media platforms and streaming services, looking at different perspectives and working out actionable solutions and best practices, which needs to be constantly reviewed and monitored.
So you can access that report. It's a relatively short report, but a very interesting summary of those various roundtables. And as we said, a very timely report given the wider debates that are happening right now. So you can download it for free from the MMF website. And Andy will put a link to where you can do that in the notes for the podcast.
And finally, on this edition of Setlist, the Featured Artists Coalition has launched a petition calling on UK Songwriters Collecting Society PRS for Music to reconsider its decision to reduce the funding it provides to the PRS Foundation. PRS confirmed last month at its AGM that the funding will be cut from the current £2.5 million a year to £1 million a year from 2024.
Now, before we get into that particular decision and the criticism of it, maybe a little bit of background. So PRS created the standalone PRS Foundation back in 2000, having previously supported new music initiatives via a less formalised donations and awards committee. Once the foundation had been created, the society committed to provide an annual grant to help support its work. And that donation comes from what PRS calls non-licence revenue, which is basically the interest that PRS earns on some of its investments, but also obviously a lot of money passes through PRS's bank account after it has collected it from users of music and other societies around the world, and before it then passes it on to songwriters and music publishers. And so as the money is sitting in the bank account, interest is accrued. And so that is the non-licence revenue, which some of which is actually shared with the membership, but a chunk of which is handed over to the PRS Foundation. Now, since its creation, back in 2000, the PRS Foundation has launched numerous schemes which provide funding to both individual songwriters and artists and also to talent development organisations, all with the aim of allowing and supporting and enabling music makers to pursue innovative music making projects and in many cases also to progress their music careers. Those schemes have funded thousands of projects over the years and have become, I would say, all the more important in the last 10, 15 years for various reasons. But we know, for example, that early career artists now often have to get further on in their career, build more momentum before traditional music industry partners like record labels and music publishers are going to start investing serious amounts of money. So at that early career level, there's a greater need for support. Meanwhile, in the digital age, you have independent artists who get opportunities to grow their audiences and their businesses in other territories abroad. So international opportunities pop up. But if they are independent artists, they don't necessarily have the money, for example, to go and play showcase festivals in those other markets. So PRS Foundation has schemes to support that sort of activity as well. Over the years, the number of schemes run by the PRS Foundation and certainly the number of artists and musicians and songwriters and organisations applying for that funding has increased significantly. And as a result, in more recent years, PRS has actually found other partners, both music industry companies and organisations, for example, the Record Industry Collecting Society, PPL, to provide some additional funding to help expand and grow those schemes.
However, the PRS grant remains a key part of the foundation's income. That is now being reduced, PRS says, because it is making less money from those interest payments than it used to. A spokesperson told The Guardian, "Donations from PRS for Music are generated separately from the royalties paid out to our members. This income has declined significantly over recent years. As such, the difficult decision was made to reduce our donations." And then providing more context, the foundation's CEO, Joe Franklin, confirmed in a statement that conversations have been ongoing for some time regarding future PRS funding, with the society's management team and members' council exploring possible alternative ways to support the charity once it became clear that the specific source of revenue from which charitable donations are made will no longer be sufficient to maintain a higher level of support. Regretfully, Franklin added, no alternative solution was found which worked for all parties, and the Members' Council delivered their decision to the Foundation in December 2021. Although insisting that the £1 million a year commitment from PRS will ensure that the foundation can continue to operate, he admitted, "This is disappointing given that PRS's overall collections are on an upwards trajectory and the society is on a path to collect £1 billion annually from its licensees."
So many in the wider music community have responded negatively to PRS's decision to reduce its funding to the foundation, insisting that if non-licensed revenue is indeed slumping, the society should have tried harder to find other ways to continue supporting the charity at the current level. After all, as Joe Frankland noted in his statement, although the monies that PRS collects and distributes to its members, to writers and publishers, were hit by the COVID pandemic and especially the shutdown of live music, which means we had a couple of years where we were looking at income and distributions of money declining. But in some ways, that is a temporary blip. And in the main, PRS's income has been growing year on year for quite some time, and we're expecting that to very much continue now that the impact of the pandemic is, in theory, hopefully behind us. And at the AGM last month, some of the reps on stage from PRS themselves admitted this ambition that Joe Frankland also alluded to, which is that PRS has ambitions to become a £1 billion society, which basically means it will be processing more than £1 billion in royalties every year. Now, many other collecting societies around the world, because of course the music industry has set up separate societies in every country, and many other societies around the world actually divert a portion of the actual royalty income that they administrate to initiatives like those run by the PRS Foundation. We should add that some societies around the world are sometimes criticised for diverting too much royalty income away from their members to these sorts of schemes, particularly when those deductions, they're sometimes called cultural deductions, apply not only to the royalties generated by the actual members of that society, but also royalties that the society is collecting on behalf of songwriters and music publishers elsewhere in the world. Nevertheless, although sometimes some people in the music community criticise excessive cultural deductions, there is a growing consensus within the UK music community that they would be happy for PRS to divert a little bit of royalty income if it could be supporting something like the PRS Foundation, and especially if the money being diverted came out of the so-called digital black box. Now I've brought up the black box, I feel we need a little bit more background here.
Yeah.
Some people in the music industry, particularly people who work at organisations like PRS and the counterparts around the world, don't like the term black box. But what does it mean? Well, black box is a colloquial term used in the music industry to describe monies collected by a collecting society, like PRS, but this is true for every society in the world, which can't be accurately paid through to specific writers and publishers, or on the recording side, artists and labels, whose music has actually been used by any one licensee of the collecting society. And the black box exists because collecting societies are often issuing licenses to less sophisticated users of music. People who use music and need to pay for the use of that music, but who are not actually in the music industry or even the media industry themselves. So like pubs, clubs, bars, cafes. And often with those users of music, they're not actually able to tell a collecting society what music they have used in any one month, quarter, or year. Or they might be able to provide some information, but it's incomplete information. And so as a result of that, it's kind of inevitable for a collecting society that at the end of every year, there's always going to be a chunk of money where they don't actually have usage data to help them distribute that money to writers and publishers, etc. And therefore, each collecting society then has to come up with some rules, what are often called distribution rules, in order to decide what to do with that money.
Societies do now receive and gather more usage data than in the past, and the use of audio ID technology should increasingly help societies identify what music has been used and therefore which members should be paid. However, for now, the black box remains. And as you said, each society has to come up with ways of distributing that income to its membership, often based on general market data. Those black box distribution rules are often controversial, perhaps inevitably, given that there will always be winners and losers, whatever rules are adopted, though the distribution of the digital black box is arguably the most controversial.
Yes, I think that's certainly true, because actually, when it comes to streaming services like Spotify, we actually know exactly what recordings have been streamed. We have incredibly good usage data for Spotify-style streaming services. However, under the way the system currently works and the way song royalties are currently calculated and paid, we have the issue, which we've talked about before on Setlist, that the streaming services like Spotify don't actually know what songs they are streaming. They know what recordings they are streaming, but they don't know what songs are contained in those recordings because they don't receive from labels and distributors the unique identifier for songs, which is known as the ISWC. So what currently happens is every month, all the services provide their licensing partners on the song side of the music industry, so that's music publishers and collecting societies, with a full usage report of every track that was streamed, identified by its recording identifier, the ISRC. And then all those licensing partners, publishers and societies, then basically need to go through that usage report, identify what songs are contained in that recording, and whether or not they control the song. And of course, obviously, song copyrights are often co-owned, so they might control 62% of the song or 33% of the song, and so on and so forth. So that process happens every month. And at the end of that process, once all the societies and publishers have done all of their matching and claiming, there will usually be a portion of streams where either the recording hasn't been matched to a song or we haven't identified 100% of the ownership of the song. So it means that there's a chunk of streaming money on the song side which can't be accurately matched to specific songs, specific songwriters, specific music publishers. And that also ends up in a black box. And like with the other black box, there then have to be rules for how we distribute that money. And quite often it is being distributed based on market share. But the reason why this is the most controversial part of the wider black box debate is, if you think about it, the publishers and societies have already had an opportunity to identify the recordings that contain their songs and identify where their works have been used and to claim the royalties they are due. So when you have a chunk of money left at the end of the month because there are certain streams where the song rights have not been claimed, well, I think it's reasonable to assume that a significant portion of that money is either going to be smaller independent publishers and writers who don't necessarily have the systems in place to be doing this matching and claiming on an industrial level every month, or in many cases, probably DIY musicians and hobbyist musicians who have written music, released it through a TuneCore or CD Baby and a DistroKid, but who aren't published, have never joined a collecting society, and so aren't even part of this system of matching and claiming works every month. So a decent chunk of that digital black box probably belongs to the grassroots music community, independent writers, super small publishers, and DIY and hobbyist musicians. In the ideal world, we would find a system to get that money to those musicians. But while we can't do that, plenty of people have argued, well, if most of that money belongs to the grassroots music community, and we can't accurately get it to each individual grassroots writer and artist, etc., why don't we use that money to fund grassroots music industry initiatives? For example, many of the initiatives run in the UK by organisations like the PRS Foundation.
Now, in the 2019 Song Royalties Guide that we produced with the Music Managers Forum and which discussed the digital black box, the MMF stated, unallocated monies should not be distributed on a market share basis, because it is almost certainly the case that unallocated monies relate to streams of songs created and controlled by more grassroots writers and publishers who never benefit when market share distributions are employed. The songwriting community should be rigorously consulted regarding what should happen to this income, it added. One solution would be to allow these monies to be distributed to grassroots music makers through the talent support initiatives many societies already operate. And in the UK, that would be the PRS Foundation. Now, in its petition, the FAC also reckons that some of that digital black box money should be used to ensure the PRS Foundation continues to have its current level of support. It notes, PRS's £2.5 million donation to the PRS Foundation in 2021 represents just 0.32% of PRS for Music's collections and 0.37% of distributions to members according to the Society's 2021 reporting. A £1 million donation would represent 0.13% of collections and 0.15% of distributions at 2021 levels. Should the collecting society reach its £1 billion target for collections, a £1 million donation to PRS Foundation represents a mere 0.1% of collections. It then cited the most recent transparency report published by PRS, which, it says, includes amounts invoiced and collected but not attributed of a massive £235 million and delayed distributions, including for data issues, of over £20 million. In other countries, the FAC goes on, monies collected by societies which are not able to be attributed to the society's members are used to fund new talent initiatives. That is not how PRS distributes such funds, it carries on, although it's not particularly clear how those funds are distributed.
As for the potential impact of the PRS Foundation's guaranteed income from PRS being reduced, FAC CEO David Martin also added, "This decision seems to have come at the worst possible time, with a difficult post-pandemic landscape, new barriers to touring in Europe, and the crippling effect of a cost-of-living crisis with its knock-on impact for touring costs and consumer confidence. It's hard to reconcile the decision to cut funding with what our sector actually needs to get back on its feet. It's hard to overstate," he went on. "We really are facing the most difficult time for our artists and songwriters in a generation, and we are at real risk of the UK ceding its status as a global music powerhouse."
You can read more about the FAC's position and petition regarding PRS Foundation funding in the link that we will include in the podcast notes.
Lots of links to include this week. I look forward to Andy Malt remembering to include all of them.
I'll do my best.
Good luck with
that. I'm sure they'll all be there. They'll all be there. I will write notes while I'm editing. It's fine. I've done this before. But anyway, that's all we've got time for. On this edition of Setlist, if you want to read more about anything we've talked about this week, go to the show notes, which are in your podcast player now, or at setlistpodcast.com. Every single link mentioned in this episode will be in those show notes.
And some more, I'm sure. Lots of links.
Extras. Things you weren't even expecting. All sorts. Just go and look now. It's great. If you've not subscribed to the show yet to receive new episodes automatically, you absolutely should, because you should. Yeah, go and do that. Also, rate and review it in wherever you know you are listening to it, if that's a thing you can do, because that helps get it in front of other people, helps other people find the show. Just tell people, tell two friends now. It's someone you haven't spoken to in more than 2 years. Text them now and tell them to listen to Setlist. No other context, no other message, just tell them that. Do that and see what happens. It could be great. You can email us about how that went at setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Or, I mean, you can email us about anything, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. We're always open to receiving emails. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.